WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
I'm not the pheasant plucker, I'm the pheasant plucker's mate. And I'm only plucking pheasants because the pheasant plucker's late.
God, what a great way to start an interview. Devoting a half hour to an issue every night really goes against the common wisdom of TV that people have a short attention span and want a lot more crammed into that half hour. Why did you choose to have a half hour to explore one issue with each night?
Well, it was partly just a sound journalistic reason, but I think as much it was a tactical decision. We thought public television needed a nightly news program. A lot of people didn't think so. If we were going to have a nightly news program on public television and demonstrate the need for it, it clearly had to be different from the news programs which were plentifully available on commercial television. There was no point, even if we'd had anything like their money, to duplicate them and do a fourth. What they did brilliantly. So we had to aim at the part they didn't do, which was thoughtful analysis and reporting in depth, and also to do something that would draw attention to ourselves, because it was very easy on public television to be ignored and just to be crushed in the kind of hurricane of commercial television publicity all the time. So what was the most different thing we could do which made journalistic sense and fitted our resources and would attract some attention to us? And it was to go totally against the grain, sort of turn the proposition upside down and say, we will do only one story a night. And that really was the thinking behind it.
I'm sure that you got a lot of advice from well-meaning people who told you it couldn't possibly work.
I remember going to lunch about 2 weeks before we went on the air with a producer who by then had become an executive at CBS News. And she said to me, you can't do that. I told her at lunch what we were planning to do. She said, you can't do that. And I said, why not? And she said, well, that's like doing an instant special every night. And what that meant in her terms was, and by the network frame of mind, I could understand what she meant. That meant you've got to get Morley Safer in London and Bruce Morton here to do 3 minutes and Roger Mudd, when he used to work for CBS, to do 3 minutes from Washington, and you'll bring in all these correspondents. And to do that every night would not only drive you crazy, but you wouldn't be able to afford it. And in her terms, she was right. It was crazy to try and do it, but we weren't going to do that. And it helped me out of my own being... One is so locked into conventional thinking, and I was, and it took a lot of effort to get out of it, and that helped. Scared me to death.
How did you state the philosophy of the show when it began?
We said we were going to try, we weren't going to try and be comprehensive, and we weren't going to be exhaustive. We were going to try and be lucid and coherent and be a program which was a complement to the network news programs. And the program was designed to follow the network news programs. We would be something in addition to what they did. And in fact, some of the early advertising for the program in New York suggested that people watch Chancellor or Cronkite or whoever and then turn to us. And in fact, that helped build a certain habit.
What strategies do you use to figure out which issue you're going to devote this half hour to?
Just the same strategy that anybody uses deciding what's the lead in a newspaper. Or perhaps a better analogy would be if you had to produce a cover of Time magazine 5 days a week, what would you put on that cover? Now, first of all, if you're going to be, it has to be news criteria, really. If you're going to be perverse enough to do only one story a night when most people offer variety, it had better be, if you can possibly do it, the story you think most people will be interested in and are expecting, and therefore a story that's in the top of the news. So the first criterion is topicality. How much on top of the news can we be? Then next, well, have we done it last night, or are we going to do it tomorrow night, the same story? We don't do them 3 days in a row. Has there been a really significant new development in a story, enough to warrant doing it again now? Or can we just leave it alone for a while? Because another of our bits of philosophy is that news doesn't need to be consumed by every American, nor does every American want to consume news in the kind of packages or times that the commercial forces behind newspapers and wire services and radio stations and television stations have led them to think news had to be consumed in. I mean, it grew up, I think, during the age of anxiety in the Cold War years. It was put out by people selling television sets and running radio stations and selling newspapers that it was almost good hygiene, kind of moral hygiene, like brushing your teeth, to consume news at regular intervals. And I think the mood of the times and the anxieties of the times contributed to that appetite. But I think as we've come out of some of those fraught periods, and especially having come through the 60s and the 70s, issues are a great deal more complicated now, and people are on to the news business a little bit. They realize it isn't absolutely necessary to have your radio on every minute of the day, consuming every last news bulletin. There are lots of Americans, we thought, and I think have demonstrated, certainly a number of millions of Americans who are quite content to get their news at a different pace. And so that is part of our philosophy. So to come back to what story you do on a particular night, it may be that there hasn't been a large enough new development significantly to change a story to require you to do it.
Robert McNeil is my guest, if you're just joining us, of the McNeil Lehrer Report, and he's also written a new autobiographical book called The Right Place at the Right Time. The standard way of covering an issue is you have someone who's for it and someone who's against it. They argue with each other a little bit with the help of a moderator, and then there's some summation at the end and the program ends. You have maybe four guests on a show, sometimes more, sometimes less. What kind of spectrum do you want to represent? Like, how, if it's a political issue, how far to the left, how far to the right do you want the person to be from? What's fair?
That's a good question, and it's very difficult to answer. I'm not sure I can answer that. We don't really think of it in terms of how extreme the parts of the spectrum represented are. We take the lines of thought that seem to be joined in an argument, that seem to be current and in the air. We don't say, oh, well, there must be a Socialist Workers' Party's point of view on this and a Communist Party point of view and a Vegetarian Party point of view, you know, the sort of full spectrum of presidential politics, for instance. And that's not to exclude that point of view. If one of those has surfaced as an interesting part of the argument, fine. But it isn't necessary to include the full political spectrum, because not all issues divide themselves by politics. For instance, we did recently a story that touched very much the lives of people in Pennsylvania, which was the Three Mile Island, the problems involved in financing the cleanup of the Three Mile Island nuclear accident. Now, that is not a program, an issue that falls neatly into left and right in American politics. You have the governor of the state of Pennsylvania more or less agreeing with the people who own Three Mile Island that the cost should be shared. You have a national association representing many municipally owned power stations around the country, which certainly is no left-wing organization, vehemently resisting the idea that costs should be shared because they don't want their consumers having to share the costs of paying to clean up a nuclear plant in Pennsylvania. You have a Republican Attorney General of the state of New Mexico who's running for senator, also resisting the cost sharing, which the Republican administration in Washington has endorsed. So not every issue. I notice you have done a story on herpes virus and how that is really ruining the lives of a lot of people and is a very distressing condition that doesn't, your attitudes to that don't fall into political identities. They may, and you could argue, I suppose, in one sense. But so it's really to represent points of view that seem significant in the argument.
Well, another pretty standard way of handling any issue with differing points of views is to stir up a good fight and really let people go at one another.
That's
it's very easy to do on television.
You asked what our philosophy was at the beginning, and well, maybe you didn't. Maybe I was just telling you.
No,
anyway,
I did.
One of them was, well, a number of tenets we had at the beginning was it's very easy to produce heat on television, and it's very hard to produce light. Because the medium just lends itself to people having an argument, and the more kind of violence is either seen or implied, the more exciting and televisual and entertaining it seems to be. And there's lots of that. And when there isn't, television loves to produce it artificially by having questions asked in a kind of prosecutorial manner, you know, as though a television interview is playing Perry Mason with his dander up, you know, browbeating some witness, which is all of it. Theatrical and false, but nevertheless creates the sense of drama and tension and violence, doesn't necessarily contribute to understanding. So if your aim is coherence, you're up against it in television, and you really got to work hard to take the ideas and, in a sense, and we've been criticized for this by some people, to de-emotionalize the issues. Take abortion, for instance. It is the easiest thing in the world, and you've seen it on 100 television programs, it's the easiest thing in the world to get a bunch of people furious and foaming at the mouth on the abortion issue. Well-meaning people, sincerely held points of view, or perhaps not sincerely held, but anyway, vehemently held and vehemently expressed. That's easy. And you can have a shouting match any day of the week. To get people to argue it calmly and discuss the realistic implications of their point of view is much more difficult.
Is that one of the reasons why you and Jim Lehrer each have, or Charlene Hunter-Gault each have your own guest to interview?
Well,
part of that
wasn't designed for neutrality. It was designed, again, partly just for drama and theatricality.
That's interesting because I always think that it helps to keep things really under control.
It does. It does that, too. And it also helps enormously because if one person is asking questions for a few minutes, the other person can listen. And there's unfortunately very little listening on television and an awful lot of talking. And you ask better questions if you listen to the answers that go before. And it helps if one person can listen while the other and think and sort of guide his interview based on what's been said so that things don't get dropped between the cracks. But you're right, it does help to cool it, because if it's just the switching from one person to another, okay, well that's the end of that bit, now we go on to the next bit. And it helps keep editorial clarity, I think, to do that.
I think one of the techniques of disarming a moderator or an interviewer is to say, I can see you're more sympathetic to the other point of view. I can just tell it on your face or in the way you're asking the question. It seems that this would make that type of accusation of bias less possible because you're dealing with different guests.
The program quickly acquired a reputation for being fair. I think it was a deserved reputation because we are fair. Now, fairness wasn't the thing we set out, you know, above all things to do. But, you know, there are a lot of attitudes in the minds of the American public about news and journalism. And I think a lot of them, some of them are paranoid, but are paranoia, but a lot of them are well-founded. The people believe the news media are unfair. The news media are unfair. I don't mean blanket. Every newspaper, every radio program, every television program, there is a lot of unfairness. What does the unfairness consist in? It consists in giving only one point of view on a story. And partly that's a product of the extraordinary brevity that is a kind of necessary ingredient or seemingly necessary ingredient in television these days. If you have only a minute to devote to the breaking aspect of a story, the chances are you're going to go into only one news source for that particular development. You get only one side of the story. American public feels they often get only one side of the story, justifiably or not. if you put on a program that most days of the week gives them a number of sides of the story, there's some reaction to that, and they feel the program is fair, perhaps unjustifiably sometimes. It's like another thing we notice. I'd always tended, as a sort of liberal journalist from the East, to dismiss as paranoia some of the groundswell of negative feelings about the press. You know, I thought a lot of it was whipped up by Spiro Agnew, and a lot of it was, and very cynically played on by people like him. But I was unaware of how deeply felt in the minds of reasonable people and how justified some of this was. For instance, a lot of people believe that the news media quote people out of context. Well, you can be defensive about it and say, oh, that's just conservative paranoia. But if you really think about it and have some experience with the media, you'll find the media do quote people out of context.
Well, but you've been quoted out of context when you've been interviewed.
I have been. And certain programs quote people out of context almost as a matter of habit. I mean, as their modus vivendi. So a program that transparently cannot quote people out of context because they're there, interviewed live, and creating their own context. They're not interviewed for half an hour and then 30 seconds used on the air. Again, gradually, over a period of time, implants in the idea of the listeners, hey, this must be a fair program. And so I think we get a disproportionate harvest of gratitude. We're only entitled to a small piece of it. And the rest of it is a kind of overreaction to the sins of our colleagues. But there are sins.
When I go home and I watch McNeil Lehrer report.
Do you watch it?
Oh, I watch it whenever I'm home at that time, which has been a lot more this year than years in the past. And I watch it as I'm cutting the stuff up for dinner and stirring it up and eating it.
A lot of people say it's only radio anyway. You don't need to watch it. You can just listen to it.
Oh, no.
I don't agree with that.
Bring all the stuff to the table and watch it. No, mm-hmm. Absolutely not. But
program to cook by, is it?
Well, yeah, it's a nice companion to have while you're cooking and eating, and it's also a time when I could really devote attention to it. Mm-hmm. But I also try to study the show because I consider it to be an ideal model, an ideal format, and it's. I really just try to see how you do it, what kinds of questions you're asking. I try to wonder what notes are you taking down, because you're always able to quote what somebody said and ask your next guest, well, how do you react to that?
Well, now, I have to take notes when people are talking, because I can't remember what they say. Now, Lehrer never takes a note, or hardly ever takes a note during a program, and he can remember verbatim what everybody says. He can sort out the wheat from the chaff, remember what people say, never drop the thread of a thing. He has a much better mind for that kind of thing than I do.
I think one thing that amazes me about you is that you're so totally unflappable on the program. No matter what somebody says, you're very cool about it. You'll ask the questions that need to be asked, and the show will keep moving. But you never do an outraged interviewer routine and, you know, really really start yelling at them or whatever, or just losing your cool.
Well, we're reporters.
And, but what do you do if someone is looking you in the eye and you know they are lying through their teeth? You know it. I mean, what do you say to them? How do you handle that?
Well, you try and challenge them and say, but isn't this the case? But didn't you say? If you have knowledge of it, you try and challenge them. One of the beauties of our format is that often we have the devil's advocate right there, which means we're not forced to play the devil's advocate, which means that we can retreat from that kind of, some of that sort of theatrical role. When we do only one person, which we sometimes do, you know, if you have Alexander Haig on or Tip O'Neill, the Speaker of the House, just for a half-hour interview as a newsmaker, we often get a lot of dirty mail accusing us of either being mean to the guy because we were playing devil's advocate or of giving him a half-hour free ride because we weren't mean to him. Because we weren't in the style of the modern television interview browbeating him. And people get so used to the format of many points of view that if you put on one, they get a little suspicious and think we're campaigning for something or giving a guy a commercial. But, you know, the reason you keep your cool is that we regard ourselves, and our training was, Jim's mostly in newspapers, mine somewhat in wire service, but mostly in television, was as reporters. And reporters don't lose their cool. They may in Hollywood movies, But they don't, as you know, in the normal run of things. You go to a press conference, there'll be 20 reporters there, and the reporters don't stand up and get angry at the person they're interviewing and say, how dare you tell me this? They just go on taking their notes. The guy's talking nonsense, they let him hang himself. And it is, that also goes to the selection of guests, to come back to another point you were asking about earlier. We try to bring into our studio the guests who would be the news sources that a good reporter would seek out if he were covering a story. If you're covering the, let's come back to herpes. If you're covering the story of herpes from a national perspective to interest everybody across the nation, what are the best sources a reporter could go to for that? Well, the Center for Disease Control in Atlanta, the woman doctor who is in charge of that investigation into herpes, and the one who recently published the report saying that it had reached epidemic proportions, 20 million sufferers, growing at 400,000 a year. That's obviously one of the best sources. Makes a very good guess. The charge is made by some that the government isn't spending enough money on this kind of research because there's an old Victorian medical bias against diseases that are sexually transmitted. Another very good source is the man at NIH, National Institutes of Health, who's in charge of research into viruses and who will defend that position. He's a resource a reporter would go to. That's why he's a guest on the program. It's said that herpes has created a psychological syndrome of its own. It gets people so upset that they have it that many of them get very depressed, depressed to the point of being suicidal about it. Because they understand it's not curable, and they get very angry at the people they've contracted it from, and so on. So there happens to be a psychologist in New York who has built up a practice around this, and he has had herpes himself. Now, he makes a very good guess. So it's the kind of sources that if you did adequate research, a reporter writing a feature article about herpes would love to be able to get to. And one of the gratifying things about the result of all this is that we find newspapers around the country and newspaper editorial writers sitting down and watching the show and writing editorials from the show, because what the show does is bring together for them the raw materials, the best sources that could be got together, when we can do it, on certain subjects. And that's very gratifying.
This is a lot smaller by comparison.
I'll end the commercial now.
This is a lot smaller by comparison, but we found out a lot of people who are in our area who we didn't know about before through watching McNeiler. So,
really?
Oh, sure.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. That's great.
Yeah. What do you do when you know an issue should be covered? It's kind of important, but it's just really not a very sexy issue. A show I can think of, I felt like, maybe I should watch it, but this is one issue I'm not really interested in. It was on, like, the laws that should regulate the sale of used cars.
Yeah.
That's what it was. And I figured, well, I'm not about to buy a used car in the near future.
Mm-hmm.
I'm really tired tonight. I think this is one I won't watch. That's the kind of issue where it's useful for a lot of people. Lots of people are buying used cars now, but it's not like a breaking war, or it's not as emotionally and physically charged as herpes.
It's funny you mention that one, because I argued on that one. And would have thought that that would have wider appeal across the United States than many, many stories on the Middle East or the Falkland Islands or whatever the state of affairs is with the Russians at the time. Because it's not only a consumer interest. Something like 30 million used cars are bought and sold every year in this country. Almost everybody in the folklore of the country has had some experience with a used car. It's very, very close to a fundamental bit of consumerism and a very important bit. It's also a matter of life and death, whether the thing is safe or not. But even more fundamentally, it seems to me, it goes to something very central in the American spirit, and that is basic honesty. It's part of American folklore that used car dealers are dishonest. By saying that, I'm not accusing any particular used car dealer. It's part of our mythology that used car dealers will lie to you. So Congress passes, so the FTC comes up with a regulation that says used car dealers can't lie. And the Congress buys that and accepts it. Used car dealers have got to tell the truth. Wow, big revolution. Now comes a counter move in the Congress to revoke that regulation and say, because there's been tremendous pressure from the used car industry, saying, no, used car dealers don't have to tell the truth that much. Now, they're trying to slide and turn and say, oh, we're not saying we don't have to tell the truth. It would just be onerous to have to tell that much truth and expensive. It would cost the customer more. Well, that's a lot of nonsense. But whether you're interested in used cars or not, that story just went to something so fundamental in this society that I thought it was could not but be fascinating to people. Now, maybe I'm wrong, but...
Well, as I say, I'm in the position of not being about to buy a used car, so...
But aren't you as an individual outraged by the idea that...
oh, definitely.
First of
yeah.
all, that somebody selling anything as important as a consumer item as a big several-thousand-dollar hunk of metal that can transport you and kill you and eat up a lot of your income and everything else, and that he could be having been corrected in his traditional pattern of, if not lying, at least telling something less than the absolute truth about it.
It's also a function of some days you're just so exasperated with things and with news that you feel like I've reached my quotient for the day. It's interesting, one of the things you just said. You said that they said, well, you know, too much truth, well, that's going to cost more and it'll hurt the consumer in the long run. You said, of course, that's nonsense. It's exactly the kind of thing you couldn't say on the program because... Obviously, you can't say, here's one side, here's the other, this point of view is nonsense, or this reason for this point of view is nonsense. How do you handle your opinions when you're going on to a show? Where do you put them?
Well, normally I handle them quite well, because the more you know about a subject, the less opinionated you are about it, really. And I've often found that...
Because it's that complicated?
Yeah, at the beginning of a day of going into research on something I didn't know much about, that I would have quite a strong opinion. And then as I read the research in the background, I would find, and Jim and I both find this, gradually, as you become more informed, you become more neutral in a way. And sometimes I've had my opinion changed on the air. I've gone onto a program, not trying not to show it, but gone onto a program thinking a certain guy's a villain, and boy, this is going to clear that up. And then come out the other end of it thinking, I'm not so sure now, or maybe he was right, which is true of many issues of the day. But on that particular program, I'm not so sure I didn't show my feeling about it a bit more strongly than usual, because there was a phrase that was used by one of the guests on the program, and I can't remember the phrase, but it was a kind of bureaucratic euphemism for lying. And I said, doesn't that mean lying? and because it just exasperated me that perhaps I feel this one too strongly.
What do you do if you're at a luncheon or something and you're giving an address and there's a question and answer period afterwards and people want to know your opinions on things, where you stand on issues, and they just so happen to be issues you're going to have to continue to cover objectively? What will you tell them?
Well, it depends what it is. On a lot of things, I simply don't have a clear opinion. Because I think a person is a damn fool if he has a clear opinion on some things. They are just too complicated. We don't know enough of the facts. For instance, I'll give you a very good example. I think it's a good example. Has this country seriously fallen behind the Soviet Union in its armaments? Now, do you know the answer to that? I have a prejudice about it. I have a personal prejudice about it. But I think there are at least two valid interpretations of the evidence. At least two interpretations of the evidence, well-known ones. One comes down to yes and one comes down to no. And they both make quite respectable arguments. The Reagan administration has chosen to say, yes, we've fallen behind because it's justification. That's its justification for a big increase in armaments. I'm not totally convinced by their argument, but I don't know. And I don't know who does know. And so what you have to do as a citizen and as a journalist and something like that is sort of pull together the best evidence you can according to your appetite for spending time on it. You know, as you say, some days you just don't feel like bothering about this stuff. Most people don't. And then rely on the word of whichever leader or politician or opinion maker you trust and to give you something. And looking carefully at their motives for telling you that. But that's a good example. you know, I'm in as good a position as most people in this country to know and to find out whether the Russians are ahead of us, so to speak, importantly ahead, taking in the whole spectrum of their strength and weakness and our strength and weakness. And I just don't know the answer to that. It's partly a political and it's partly a psychological and it's partly a factual and economic as well as military equation. And I would be a damn fool if I got up and said, yes, this is the case, or no, this isn't the case.
Robert McNeil is my guest, one of the co-anchors of the McNeil Lehrer Report, and I think you don't use the term anchors. I should have come up with the term you use. And he's also written a new autobiography called The Right Place at the Right Time. Now, say we took another issue like abortion, which one doesn't need to study the figures for in the same way one does for the arm race, or something like the effect of Reagan's budget cuts on social welfare in America. Would you express an opinion to the public on that, or is it your responsibility to withhold that?
Well, I you can argue that both ways. I would prefer not to because on an issue like abortion, that would, in the mind of one side or the other, immediately convince those who heard that I wasn't capable of reporting the issue fairly. Now, if they think about it very hard, people who get upset by things like that, if they thought about it very hard, they would realize that anybody, most of us who are reasonably well-informed people, have opinions on these things. And I have. But I think all I do is bring down on my head a bunch of people who will say, oh, well, that disqualifies you as an objective reporter on these. So I prefer not to just for that.
Well, in the early 70s, when you joined public television with NPAC, the National Public Affairs Center for Television.
Gee, you remember the name.
This was a time when the Nixon administration was accusing you and other people in public television in general, as bringing a liberal bias to the news and to every issue that you presented. Since you've described yourself as a liberal journalist, what was your reaction to that? And then we'll talk about evidence that...
Sure. Well, I am a liberal. I mean, I am a political liberal. And there's no... I don't make any bones about that. I think it's distressing that liberalism has become so much in disgrace at the moment in this country that even people who are won't admit it and find other ways of saying it. Liberalism is one of the great Western traditions of intellectual and political thought, and liberalism created this country. The great strain of liberal thought created this country. This country was born in liberalism. And it's distressing to me to have it put about these days that liberal thinking is somehow weak or soft thinking, and that the only realists are conservatives. I mean, that's nonsense. There are realistic conservatives and realistic liberals, and it suits my psychology to look at things in a liberal way. But when the Nixon administration attacked public affairs and news on public television at that time, what they neglected to do was to look at the content of what we were doing. They had their political reasons for doing it, and they looked at the past record of, chiefly, of Sandy Van Oker, who was my partner, who had been quite outspoken on a couple of things during the Vietnam War. I had too, but I was much less well known than he was, and very few people paid any attention. He became a kind of lightning rod. But they weren't looking at what we were saying on the public television airwaves. We covered the 1972 election every week for 43 weeks, and I think you'd have to look very hard at any of those half-hour programs to find outright liberal bias in them. They were extremely neutral programs. But they were, for their own political motives, they decided that there shouldn't be any news in public affairs on television, and they went on public television, they went about killing it in the most blatant way, and it's delicious now because one rarely has this kind of after-the-fact satisfaction. What they did to public television, which was our sort of mini Watergate, our little corner of Watergate, is better documented than anything they did in the real Watergate, because they not only talked about doing it, they wrote memos to each other about what they were doing. And every one of those memos now, they wrote memos and they even said in the memos, we shouldn't be writing memos to each other because somebody will find out and put this out. After, under the Freedom of Information Act a few years ago, there were released some 10,000 pages of White House documents concerning public television. It's all there in black and white. And it's wonderful to discover that what we thought was paranoia, we said, they can't be after. The president himself can't be wasting time trying to kill news on public television. We must be paranoid about this. We're too worried. And there it is in black and white, what they were doing, including the president.
I think part of what they tried to do is plant stories in the press that you were all making salaries higher than the vice president,
yeah.
And how could the public condone that? What are some of the other damning things that you found?
Well, one of the things they did was they got to public television stations around the country, which were in, as they always have been, in economic straits, worried about where their next dollars were coming from, and suggested to them that unless they got these so-called liberal commentators off the airwaves, that their own station funding was going to be in jeopardy, and the funding of public television was going to be in jeopardy. And a lot of stations believed that.
Since public television still doesn't have either the budget or the numbers and audience that commercial television has, does it affect your access to stories? Like if you're after a story or after a person that a commercial network is after also, might they be more apt to land it because of that clout that comes with numbers and money?
If it's changed in the first, in the first couple of years, if Meet the Press wanted somebody and we wanted somebody, suppose Margaret Thatcher was coming here and everybody knows in advance and everybody wants her. So Meet the Press invites her. Quite often a program like that or Face the Nation will try and make a bargain with that newsmaker and say, we'll put you on for half an hour if you won't do any other program before us. And suppose we reached her, our invitation got there about the same time, and we wanted to put her on the Friday before the Meet the Press appearance. In the first couple of years, they would have won hands down easily because those were all the recognized outlets for that kind of interview. Gradually, it's become closer and closer, and I think probably it's fairly even now with a lot of people. And some big newsmakers will choose us in preference because they think they'll get a clearer opportunity to explain their point of view more coherently. On other issues, we find it easier to get people often than programs like The Today Show or Good Morning America. We're in very even competition with them, and some people will say they'll choose to come on our program because they'll get a clearer shot at explaining their point of view, even though very often they're going to face other people who are very critical.
Getting back to public television.
May I just add one other
thing?
There is also the people are very keen to reach the public television audience. And our numbers are not any longer so insignificant. We regularly get now about 4.5 million people a night watching. And over a week, the regular audience for the McNeil Lehr Report we discovered recently, that is people who watch several times a week or tune in several times a week out of habit, don't always stay with every program because it may not interest them, but are part of the regular audience is 15 million people. And they're people that a lot of them are opinion leaders. A lot of them, there's a high proportion in that public television audience, as I'm sure there is in yours, of people who are very activist, who relatively activist, who've in the last year written to a congressman or voted or attended a school board meeting or some other public meeting, who really participated as citizens. And, people who are making news like to reach that kind of person.
Robert McNeil is my guest if you're just joining us, and his new autobiography is called The Right Place at the Right Time. And, of course, the McNeil Lehr Report can be seen in the Delaware Valley 7 o'clock each weekday evening on Channel 12. We've talked a little bit about objectivity. Does everyone in the news business really know what everybody else in the news business truly thinks on a subject? Do you know what all the network anchors' real opinions are of stories and what the reporters' behind-the-scenes personal opinions are?
No, but I think it's fair to say, the charge was always made by conservatives, political conservatives in the United States, that conservatism never became respectable as a political force, or so slowly became respectable, because most of the news media were of a liberal cast of mind. And I think there is probably still a rough truth to that, a rough truth, that the kind of education we have, the kind of backgrounds one comes from, do probably make more liberals as journalists than conservatives. I think that's true. So I probably know, I can roughly guess, what most of my colleagues are thinking. And the chances are their private opinion, would be more the liberal side, say, of the abortion issue than the conservative side. That doesn't mean that they are incapable of informing people objectively. And I think that's where the, particularly the conservative, but the sort of uninformed paranoia of so much of the new right, particularly, is on weak ground. They assume because commentator X is liable to hold liberal opinions himself, and that doesn't mean that all of them do, that that biases and bends what he's doing, and that by a twitch of his eyebrow or the selection of a story or the turn of a phrase or something, he's going to be... that he disqualifies himself as an objective reporter. That's confusing commentators and columnists with reporters. It's confusing the anchorman function, which is simply to deliver the news dispassionately, with the commentator function. And mind you, television people do that themselves. But I think, yes, I do know what most of them probably think, although I'd be wrong a lot of the time, too, because... while it's true that the American press, national press, probably has a strong liberal bias, in fact, there was a survey done recently that demonstrated factually that this is true, it's also in many ways becoming more conservative. It's very conservative, for instance, on the survey that I'm quoting, revealed the sort of opinion leaders in... American journalism based in New York and Washington as quite conservative on sort of on private enterprise, free enterprise, competition in the American system. Very strong supporters, very little sort of inclination towards socialist solutions to economic problems. Very liberal when it comes to social issues. Things like attitudes towards homosexuality. For instance, I was startled to discover that something like 87% of the people surveyed in this thing that I'm quoting said homosexuals should not be prevented from being teachers in schools. That's a very liberal position to take. Whereas, 79% said homosexuality is not wrong. They disagreed with the statement homosexuality is wrong. 52% said adultery is not wrong. Now, these are some numbers actually to go on to indicate the liberalism of the press. But you'd also find a corresponding set of attitudes to America's position in the world and the business of America being business, which would be somewhat conservative or middle of the road. So it's not by any means all one way.
You know what I'd like to know? Did you ever have nightmares about the program?
No.
Really?
No, I don't at all. This is the most anxiety-free job I've ever had.
But it's live.
Yeah, but its very liveness is liberation.
Mm-hmm. Well, because you don't have to reform it after it's all over, it's done.
There's that. And if you make a mistake, that's too bad. You'll try not to make them the next time. And if you do something every day, a number of things happen. For one thing, if you do something every... is your show daily?
It's daily and it's live.
Yeah. Well, then you know what I mean. If you do something every day, you organize your life, you organize your metabolism around it. You begin to become efficient in your use of energy about it. A man who lays bricks every day, unless he's neurotic, doesn't go out with deep anxiety every day about laying bricks. He may the first few weeks when he's just an apprentice graduate bricklayer. But he doesn't worry every day about getting it straight and putting the right amount of mortar in when he's pointing the bricks and getting them level and making it safe and everything. He gradually does all that instinctively, and he takes considerable pride in doing it. And he's probably, if he has anxiety in his life, it's about other things. It's about his relations with his wife or whether he's making enough money or how he's getting on with his kids or something like that. And there's a doing every day is wonderful therapy. Something every day is wonderful therapy in a way. I mean, unless it's an absolute disaster and it's not working at all, in which case you'd stop doing it. So it is very unconstipating intellectually to do something every day. It's when you're doing something occasionally or monthly or weekly that you have time to get uptight about it and so on. So I don't have nightmares about it. And live is wonderful. It's when you have to tape something that they say, oh, it's got to stop, start that again. Whenever we tape a program, something goes wrong. You know, they roll a piece of film late or something, which almost never happens when you're doing it live.
I guess the that feeling of it having less anxiety than some other shows and the control that you have over the program is maybe part of the reason why you've turned down the lucrative offers you've been made to join commercial television again.
Yeah, that's I don't want to give the impression that, you know, there's a commercial television network banging on the door every minute. It is by no means the truth, but I have had one or two, and so has Jim. And they were lucrative, but nothing. I've worked in a commercial television network, NBC, and I know the kinds of anxiety that those places almost breed. And the tension, if your purpose in life is to attract the maximum possible number of viewers, arithmetically, to watch a television program, because that will raise the amount of advertising revenue that your network can extract from that program, then all other purposes are going to be a victim to that principal purpose. And after all, the American commercial networks are not primarily in the business of putting on programs or putting on news. They're primarily in the business of delivering audience in the right sort of demographic quantities and sizes to sponsors at the most efficient or lucrative cost per thousand. That's the business they're in. What they do as programs is incidental to that, and at times it seems they'll do almost anything as programs in order to achieve that. So if your primary purpose is, as I've described, then all your other purposes are going to become prisoners of that purpose. And your news is going to be shaped and manipulated and molded and bended as any other commodity and as any other piece of entertainment on television to better suit that purpose. And the careers of the people who ride on that. Think of Dan Rather's position. He's a wonderful guy, Dan Rather, and he deserves every success that he's had. I mean, he's an attractive, vibrant, aggressive, energetic, intelligent guy. He came in to succeed Walter Cronkite at a fabulous salary. I don't know what it is. It's over $1 million. And immediately everybody began attacking him and nitpicking him and watching the ratings go and saying he was too stiff and everything else. Imagine how he felt as the ratings fluctuated there. I imagined him one time feeling like a man in an electric chair whose wires from the electric chair didn't go out to one switch where the executioner was going to pull the switch, but to about 20 million little switches, tiny, tiny little wires. And everyone out there, at least half of those 20 million, couldn't have given a damn about the news. They're just there because that's what you do at that time of day, and that's the network you're going to watch. And in the middle of all the alarms of domestic life at that time of day, the cooking and the how did you things go at the office today and shut up children and what's going on and Jones is sick and so on, you are, in a sense, metaphorically in the middle of all that, you're holding two little tiny wires together and deciding, contributing to the voltage that will either catapult Dan Rather out of the electric chair or make him secure there. And it's all so extraordinarily arbitrary. And you know damn well that most of the people, that there'd be just as many people around CBS who would be privately delighted to see him get catapulted out of the chair as will be delighted if he succeeds. And that kind of atmosphere is killing. Just something I, Laren, I don't want anything, any part of. Mm-hmm. And not to have it is wonderful. Besides, it just seems so absurd to me. that television should have been allowed to grow up the way it has, and this is the rationale for public broadcasting, yours and mine. It is absolutely absurd that something which could attract 5 million people would not be competitive because something else could attract 10 million people. That's an absolute absurdity. I mean, suppose that television had been invented around the time the printing press were, and the criteria that the Paleys and the Sarnoffs and the other people have allowed to spring up in commercial network television had governed the publication of books all these years. The libraries of the world would look like the worst airport bookstalls, where mostly you're very lucky if there's a sort of Faulkner reprint, you know, down in the corner somewhere, and the chances are it's going to be nothing but the latest, most lurid, bosomy, sort of half-clad girl escaping from a gothic house, or something much more direct and of the moment in its titillation. The whole civilization would be different if the principal medium of communication, mass communication, printing, had been treated culturally as the now principal medium of mass communication has been treated by and large commercially in this country. I'm onto my real hobby horse. I could go on for hours about that. I just think that's monstrous, and it's the essential justification for what you do and what we do.
Would you just tell us a little bit about what your typical day is like? I've always wondered how you prepare for the show, what you read, and what you also do in a typical day to prevent yourself from burning out, which is, a very likely result of being under the pressure and under the constant changing issues that you would have to deal with.
The best thing about our day is that we are editors. And the day goes by really being editors, like an editor in a small newspaper or a small magazine. And the performance part of it, the part that in all other television situations I've been in, is the thing that gives you anxiety and gradually builds during the day, because everything is squeezed into the performance. Instead of being like the violinist who worries all day up to concert time, or the singer, or the actor who does that, there is very little time to worry about that because we are acting as editors all day. We come in at about 10:30 in the morning, which is very late. And so we have each of us time in the morning not to burn out, to read or do other writing. The book you mentioned, I wrote in the mornings before I went to work. Just to do other things, listen to music, water the garden, do things like that. And then at 10:30, we decide whether the program that we've probably planned to do, because most of the time you've planned ahead, should go, or whether we should change it because of some breaking story. And the staff is arranged with 9 reporters who work to 5 producers, and they all specialize in different areas of the news. And they're all responsible for those, which is another thing that relieves our anxiety a great deal. And they keep abreast and keep in touch, as newspaper reporters with beats do. And they advise us whether they think we should be doing something in one of their beats. It'll be pretty obvious to us, too. I mean, if Britain has invaded the Falkland Islands, it's all over the newspapers and all over the television, and you know maybe you ought to pay some attention to that. But we discuss for the first half hour or so what to do that day. Now, if it's something we have to jump on and change everything, perhaps that editorial discussion goes on longer and people will be in and out of our 2 offices for most of the morning. And the rest of the morning is future planning, answering mail, talking with reporters and producers about programs they may have questions about or queries about coming up in the next few weeks. I mean, we have people out shooting things in the field, and we have interconnections to plan, and we have the schedule of this person to adjust against that. In other words, it's administrative but editorial stuff. At lunchtime, we have lunch. Now, Lehrer, by long tradition, long newspaper tradition, usually eats a sandwich in his office. And I, because most of my reporting experience was in Europe, got in the habit of going out and eating lunch. And I go out and eat lunch, and I talk to news sources or friends, and I relax there. And then in the afternoon, if nothing else is going on, if we're not doing any other thing, then from about 2 through to 2 to 3, depending on what time we get to grips with it, we then study for that night's program. And studying means absorbing a background package and pre-interviews with guests that the reporter and producer team for that night have put together, asking them questions about it, trying to clarify things, asking them for more information if we need it, talking to each other about what it all adds up to and means. And then around about 4 o'clock, I write the lead to the program, and usually if it's a breaking story, that involves reading all the wires of that day. Jim writes the off-lead, and we write the introductions to the guests each of us is going to interview. And then we hand that to the reporter and the producer who edit them, and then those are exchanged between the two cities, and they get typed up for the teleprompter. And then the reporter in each question has interviewed all the guests in advance and has given us a précis of that interview, sometimes in question and answer form, sometimes just a summary form, sometimes as much as 2 or 3 close-typed pages from each guest. So we have a very good idea. And we also read speeches the guest has made or articles he's written or pieces of books and things like that. So we have a very good idea of what the guest wants to say. And the reporter and the producer have worked out an outline for the program, and they have suggested questions. Now, what we do each is take the questions they've suggested, read the interviews with the people in advance, and sort of sit there and think about it a bit, and then say, now, each of us in his own mind, what are the 4 or 5 or 6 best questions we could devise from culling out of everything that from our experience will best elicit this and join the argument and everything? And then we write those questions down. Then, at about 6 o'clock, we get on a telephone hookup between the two cities with loudspeakers, and the reporter and the producer and Jim and I and the executive producer and anybody else who's interested come in, and we read through the questions. Jim will read the questions he's going to ask one guest, and we'll discuss them. And then I'll read through the questions I'm going to, and we'll discuss them. And if the reporter and the producer think we've missed the boat or got it wrong, they'll tell us, and we'll discuss it around, and then we leave for the studio. And in the studio, unless the person is a sort of government official, you know, with some position, in which case you usually don't tell him what you're going to ask him because it's obvious that you're going to talk to him about something that's in the news. But if it's just ordinary people like doctors or businessmen or people who are news sources, since they've been interviewed in advance and we know their positions, we say, look, there are no secrets here. We're not here to surprise you or shock you. I plan to ask you these sorts of questions. They may change depending on what's been said ahead of you. I plan to ask you these kinds of questions. And that relaxes the guest a lot if he feels he's not there to be trapped into something, that we're there to help elicit what we know he wants to say. And that creates a kind of calmness, I think.
Well, it certainly comes across on the program. Thanks so much, Robert McNeil, for talking with us.
It's a great pleasure.